Okay, my title is Supersymmetric Ground States. On moduli spaces. So this is supposed to be a report on work that's been going on in differential geometry and Lie group theory over the last 30 years or so. Work that hopefully will interest both mathematicians and physicists alike. The best way for me to start to organize the talk is just to tell you a result, and then I'll try to explain the components of that result, and then give you some idea of how mathematicians gave a proof and what are the problems that still remain. All right, so I think most of you know that non-compact groups have been playing a considerable role in string theory and supergravity theory for some time now. So I'm going to state a result about non-compact simple Lie groups. So G here is a real connected simple Lie group, and you can think about the group SO plus PQ as a good example. The plus just means that I take the component of the identity. And then K is some choice of maximal compact subgroup. So in the example, that would be just SOP cross SOQ. Since I'm back to compact groups, I don't need the plus anymore. So you might think about this as already applying, for example, to Narayan compactifications. Or to K3 compactifications. In this case, the particularly interesting example is well, in a second, we're going to divide G by K, and in particular, this homogeneous space is known now by the work of many people, including Aspinwall and Morrison, to be connected with K3 compactifications. It's not the moduli space of K3 surfaces. It's a more subtle object. So then G mod K, this is the symmetric space. Of G, and it comes with a canonical Riemannian metric. Lift that up a little bit. Okay, so this is the geometrical logic that we're interested in. All right, so let me make myself a little more room here. Then we can consider what mathematicians call arithmetic groups and what physicists would call duality groups. So we're going to consider discrete subgroups. And I usually take them to be assume that gamma is arithmetic. Now, actually, that has a fairly complicated definition in pure mathematics, and I'm not going to try to review that. But I think that if you have any experience in this game, you know of some examples, and that already counts for a lot. So, for example, gamma in SO plus PQ, take it to be the stabilizer of a z-lattice. In RPQ. Okay, that would be a perfectly good example. Or perhaps even more basic example would be SLNZ sitting inside of SLNR. Or another example to think about would be the group E7, 7Z inside of E7, 7R. Now, here there's a question of what you really mean. E7, 7R is a particular group in Ailey-Cartan's classification of real simple Lie groups. So this group goes back to the beginning of the century. If you actually look at the way Cartan constructed the group, it has a real 56-dimensional representation. And there is a nice lattice in that representation which defines this subgroup. It's actually a remarkable construction that Cartan gives. He has the integers in mind already, and not just the real numbers. I was especially excited when I saw this group appear roughly 20 years ago in work on 11-dimensional supergravity and its toroidal compactification to 4 dimensions. All right, so those are some examples to think about.
Okay.
Yes? I believe so. Yeah, because Cartan has a very explicit construction. It's a very explicit basis for the 56-dimensional representation. So you can take the basis to be the generator of the Z lattice.
That's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. I'm trying to emphasize that there is at least one example which is well known to both mathematicians and physicists. There are many other, you shouldn't get the wrong idea, however, that there are many other arithmetic subgroups of these real V groups, and in fact, the full theory of classifying them is a rather abstruse branch of mathematics. It's called the theory of algebraic groups. So I don't want to get into that. It's pretty clear that in physics you have very particular arithmetic groups in mind. So that's why I don't want to get into the general theory. Another thing that I want to emphasize is that my examples typically are going to be associated with moduli problems in physics, not necessarily moduli problems in algebraic geometry. So, of course, we use the word moduli these days in a much more general sense than Riemann used the word back in the 19th century. I used to think that the only moduli problems that were of interest were those connected with, say, classification of abelian varieties or K3 surfaces. But those are rather special compared to the problems that physicists are looking at. All right, so if you'll allow me, I'll continue to talk in a strictly mathematical vein. I want to try to state a theorem. And as the theorem is stated, it goes back to two mathematicians at the Tata Institute. This is a work from about 1979. And it says the following. For each G, there is a computable positive integer MG with the following constraint. The real rank of G is less than or equal to MG is less than or equal to half the dimension of G mod K, such that if you don't know about real rank, I'll come back and explain that in a minute. It's a basic invariant of the symmetric space. Such that for any arithmetic subgroup gamma and G, and for any square integrable harmonic P form on gamma mod G mod K, following holds. If P is less than MG, then the pullback of omega to G mod K is G invariant. All right, so I have to discuss the logic of this a little bit. I'm sorry? Harmonic, yeah, for any square root of a harmonic P form omega. Yeah, thanks. All right, so the logic of this is that I start with a group over the reals, right, a real Lie group. And the theorem tells me that there's a certain constant associated to the group, which only depends upon the group and nothing else. So it's a kind of a universality statement, which tells me that for any arithmetic subgroup, I don't get anything interesting in the square integrable harmonic forms until I go up to at least dimension mg. All right, so this is a little backwards to state the theorem first without stating some of the background, but I think this will help to focus my lecture if I do it this way. Okay. So let's first of all talk about real rank. All right. So this can be defined in several different ways. It's the dimension of a maximal vector subgroup A, such that every element of A is semi-simple. Okay, so that would be a group theoretical definition. Semi-simple means diagonalizable in the adjoint representation. And vector subgroup just means isomorphic to R to some power. And you see, when you're talking about compact groups, you usually talk about maximal tori. When you talk about non-compact groups, there's several different types of maximal abelian subgroups that you're interested in. You want to restrict yourself to abelian subgroups where every element is semi-simple. Otherwise, you don't get a very tractable theory. But then another way to define this real rank, which is considerably more geometrical, is to say that it's the dimension of a maximal flat subspace of G mod K. So as you can look at the subspaces of G mod K that under the induced metric are Euclidean spaces, and then you can look at the dimension of a maximal such subspace. Okay, so the real rank is telling you something about the extent to which the symmetric space fails to be constant negative curvature. If the real rank is exactly 1, then we have constant negative curvature. Otherwise, we now have planes or higher dimensional subspaces which have zero curvature. Okay. So we have to be more careful with the geometry.
I'm confused about the SL2R case. There, the diagonal will be a maximal vector subgroup.
Right.
So that's dimension 1.
Right. Right.
So it doesn't have a...
Well, it has lines.
Oh, you're allowing a flat.
Yeah.
I didn't understand.
Yeah. Okay. All right, so what else should I be explaining here?
You have to be in a discussion about MG ever being bigger than the real rank. Like the theorem is equivalent to just substituting real rank for MG.
Yeah, but I'm going to tell you a little bit more about it. Yeah. So, actually, it turns out that there is an interesting history of this theorem. It was known to, Ron brings up a good comment. It was known that you had a correct theorem if MG was the real rank itself. But then Kumarazan and Partisarity pushed it up to a better estimate. So, maybe I should comment about that. So for SO plus PQ, with P less than or equal to Q, the real rank is equal to P, and the M is equal to P. So that's the best that's known in that case. And in fact, that's probably sharp. On the other hand, for E77, okay, well, sort of by this notation, the real rank is 7. This is a case where you have the full root structure living over the real numbers. Okay. So it's the so-called normal form of Cartan. And then it turns out that the M of this group is 15. Okay, so this is at least twice the rank. To give you another example, which is, I think, the most dramatic. This is a group that's still of interest in supergravity theory. If you think about toroidal compactification of 11-dimensional supergravity down to 3 dimensions, this is the group that was shown by Kramer, Shirk, and Julliard to show up in the theory of the scalar fields. Then the real rank is 8, and the M turns out to be 29. All right, so that's a rather strange number. Let's see. Just to keep track of things here, half the dimension of the symmetric space is equal to 64 in this case. So you're getting well on the way to half the dimension of the symmetric space. Remember, the symmetric space is related to a half spin representation of the maximal compact subgroup in this case. Half the dimension of the symmetric space here is 35. Okay, so that 15 is well on the way to the 35. Okay. Okay, so any questions? Yes?
Do you have to say something about the D mod gamma being finite volume? Or is that implied by
our Okay, so by the standard mathematical definition of arithmetic, it implies finite volume. Yeah. Difficulty in mathematics is that the converse is not always true. But it's actually, it's a remarkable fact that if the real rank of G is at least 2, then a discrete subgroup with finite volume has to be arithmetic in the mathematician's definition of arithmetic, which I'm hiding. That's the result of Margulis. All right, so what else should I be explaining here? Well, and I should talk a little bit about the G invariant forms.
It becomes systematic if you do this E series over there. What is number M?
The number M is computed in a completely crazy way. I'm going to talk about that. So. No, it does not seem to have a simple. I mean, I have a table I can show you. It does not seem to have a simple relationship to the rank. I mean, I don't want you to. I mean, it's not like the New York subway system. Yeah. Okay. Well, now that's of course the right question. I mean, going any further, I would say that as long as I allow arithmetic subgroups of this type in SO plus PQ, then I believe the result is sharp, but I don't know that the result is written down. I would guess that you'd have to go to some work of Jean Shu Li at University of Maryland. That's an interesting special case. I'll come back and comment on that.
That there
is a it's actually a P form where P is exactly the rank. So it's where P is actually equal to this P.
Oh, less than
M. Yeah. Sorry about that confusion in notation, but it shouldn't create too much of a difficulty. Now, with SLNR, I believe it's also known that you can achieve a non-invariant form at the real rank, which is n minus 1. But now with this exceptional group, I don't think anything is known. No, I don't think that makes things any better. You'd like to see the number for E6, and I have it in my office. Okay. I did not memorize that. Sorry. I mean, to guess a pattern out of three numbers, Robert, I think you have to be pretty insightful. Okay. All right. Any other questions at this point? All right, so, of course, this is a theorem which would become, I think, a little bit more concrete if I told you about the invariant forms. That's something that any expert in symmetric spaces knows, but I don't want to assume that of the whole audience. So, where shall I go? Okay, well, this is a simple story. It turns out that these correspond, well, first to K invariant. Vectors. Ah, okay, very good. Let me come back to your question. I just wanted to say something elementary here. Take just the forms that live at the identity. So E is the identity coset. And then you get a certain Grossmann algebra here of forms. I'm sorry? That's right. Wedge P is for peak forms, yeah. The usual convention, yeah.
It's the grading on the exterior algebra, the same as the grading of the forms of U1K.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about the cotangent bundle and its exterior powers. Okay, so that's actually almost immediate from the group theory. But then it turns out that this can be reviewed from a point of view of topology. So let's let GU be the compact dual of G. Okay, so this is a famous concept in theory of real groups and symmetric spaces. So this is the i.e. GU is compact and the complexified Lie algebra of GU is equal to the complexified Lie algebra of G. Okay, so again, let's talk about some examples. If I talk about SLNR, the compact dual is SUN. If I talk about SO plus PQ, then the compact dual is SOP plus Q. If I talk about E77R, compact dual is what you would just call E7 in physics, just the compact E7. So the duality is that well, is at first that you have let's not call it dual. I think that at this conference that's perhaps a mistake. Yeah, I understand what you're driving at. Okay, so the compact twist. Can I get away with that? I know you use the word twist for a whole lot of other things, but okay. So it's the compact group which has the same algebra over the complex numbers. Okay. Now there is something called duality in this game, but I mean, you know, the word duality, you guys didn't invent that. So this, the way things are set up is that you can embed K inside of GU in a natural way. So then GU mod K is the compact dual of G mod K. I think that's a correct use of the mathematical terminology. Okay, and what I'm saying is that can be arranged in a standard way. Okay. In fact, I think maybe in a minute I'm going to have to explain that in more detail. So It turns out that you can play the game of invariant forms on this dual symmetric space, GU mod K. So this is this turns out to be isomorphic as an algebra to this same space. All right, so I think maybe the best thing to do is this. Let's write G naught as the Lie algebra of G. And then we're going to decompose that into two pieces. So let's say question? It doesn't matter. Yeah, K invariant. Right, thank you. Yeah. Okay, so these are the K invariants. Okay, so you split the Lie algebra of G into the Lie algebra of K plus an orthogonal complement. And then the Lie algebra of of the compact dual has this form. So from that point of view, you see that you're dealing with almost the same complex Lie algebra. You've just made a very systematic change here. So actually, you can write this as the exterior algebra on P naught. Upper K. And likewise over here. All right, but now you see you're dealing over here with a compact symmetric space. And it's known that for compact symmetric spaces, the invariant forms are the same as the harmonic forms. So GU invariant forms are harmonic, and vice versa. So now we're really talking about the real cohomology of GU mod K. So finally, G invariant forms G mod K become isomorphic to the real cohomology of G U mod K. And that can be understood from classical techniques. All right, so I take the G invariant forms then to be well understood. One example of this is that you can check that for You can check that for this space. Any G invariant form omega has degree congruent to 0 mod 4. And that can be argued using classifying spaces and characteristic classes. What that actually says is interesting about this particular example. It says that I don't have to be quite so careful in how I state a vanishing theorem. So in this case, theorem implies if omega is L2 harmonic, on G mod K mod gamma, and the degree of omega is equal to P, then either P is equal to 0 and omega is the constant function, or P is at least 4. So there's a gap here. You can't find anything strictly between 0 and 4. Now, I have to say that I was emboldened to talk about the subject by the third of Witten's lectures last week, where he talked about harmonic forms on moduli space of flat bundles. And he was talking about various gaps in the cohomology. I have no idea really what the analogous physical interpretation would be in this example, but it would presumably have something to do with the work on compactification of particular string models. Okay.
Have any sort of geometric vanishing theorems in low dimensions? Richie is positive, then you'll know H1 is 0.
So that's a very good question. I think I've got another question on the line. You're asking about curvature. It turns out that for examples that I'm looking at, the curvature is bounded from the sectional curvature is bounded from above by 0. So you don't have any positive sectional curvatures anywhere. I think that there are.
Well, that's for G mod K, but of course,
yeah. Yeah, well, for G mod K, I suppose you could use curvature arguments, but I think that people prefer to use classifying spaces just to get a complete calculation. I think it's one of the motivations for classifying spaces, is to get the cohomology of these compact homogeneous spaces. In the non-compact case, the case that I started with, the differential geometers did have an argument about H1 using curvature. That seems to go back to Matsushima in the mid-60s. So if the real rank is at least 2, there's a curvature argument that shows that you can't have something interesting at degree 1. But that's about the best that you can say by purely curvature theoretic techniques. So, of course, I'm not discussing the proof of this yet, so it's a complete mystery. Let me answer another question. Greg asked, what about these spaces? G mod K mod gamma, are they manifolds? And of course the answer is in general no, they're in general orbifolds. But you can say something a little bit better than that. All right, so it's a classical result, but I forget who actually proved it in this generality. Maybe Borel. And at a physics math meeting, I should remind you, I'm talking about a mathematician named Armand Borel. This is not the Borel of Borel summability. So it says that given an arithmetic subgroup, there exists a normal subgroup gamma tilde of finite index such that gamma tilde has no fixed points. On G mod K. All right, so it's a typical mathematical statement. I'm not telling you that I know for particular groups how large this finite index has to be. I think that's an extremely interesting question, particularly in the light of the examples that I've been emphasizing. But this does at least say that you can set up a picture like this. You can think of gamma GK is a quotient of the manifold gamma tilde GK by the finite group gamma mod gamma tilde. So this is a little stronger statement than saying that you have an orbifold. Orbifold means that locally your manifold looks like a quotient by a finite group. But in fact, globally, your manifold is a quotient by a finite group. Maybe a very large group, but... Even in that case, I don't know the answer. Yeah, I mean, I think that would be something worth looking into. Another thing that I want to emphasize is that these spaces are definitely non-compact in general. Yeah, okay. So in mathematics, you can sometimes reinterpret this covering space as a moduli space. With the pen on what G you're talking about. For the examples that show up in physics, I'm not sure that you can give a simple physical interpretation. I mean, that's a question that I have for you. The example I'm thinking about is quotients of Ziegel upper half space, where you can talk about abelian varieties with level structure. But I don't know whether that generalizes to other moduli problems that are of more interest in physics.
Well, because here you want to specify the sudden transformation of the identity mod P or mod N.
Mm-hmm.
And my guess is that level 3 might work there also, because the biggest problem is going to be caused by reflection.
Mm-hmm. But do you have a connection between that and the physics of K3 compactifications? Can you see where that level 3 would show up?
Not
okay.
But mm-hmm. The whole theory is fact, right?
Yeah.
It's good to know that you can do this level at that level. Mm-hmm. You really want to work with the orbital
kind of stuff. Depends upon what school you come from. Yeah, if you come from the Langland school, as I do originally, all levels are of equal importance. Okay, so I just want to make a couple of other points about these spaces to convince you that there's something interesting going on here. The gamma G mod K is in general non-compact. Okay, so it's a generalization of the phenomenon with SL2Z inside of SL2R, where you have a cusp. You will have cusps and generalized cusps for these spaces, and this has been studied extensively in the mathematical literature. What this means is that Hodge theory fails. It's not the case that the real cohomology can be identified with the L2 harmonic forms. Now, I think in mathematics, the ordinary cohomology of this space is regarded as the problem. I mean, there's a subject called cohomology of arithmetic groups, which goes back now 40, 50 years, where the ultimate goal is to calculate the cohomology of the space with some coefficients that we'd be happy with real. Singular or Durand. Yeah. However, as I'm understanding the concept of a supersymmetric ground state, you want to have some connection with quantum mechanics over this non-compact manifold, and so you really want to work on the L2 side of the Hodge theorem. Hodge theorem is now working, but it's really the L2 harmonic forms that you're interested in. So it turns out that actually is a good thing, because if I tried to state the Coomerasin-Partisarity theorem in terms of Durand cohomology, it would be false. This even the vanishing below the real rank modulo the G invariant forms is false if you talk about ordinary Durand cohomology. Okay, I'm not going to go into details of that, but I think, for example, with SLNR, you have to worry about all kinds of forms that have degree between a quarter of the rank and the rank. Those forms are not square integrable, but they contribute to the cohomology. So there's something of a bifurcation here between the problem that the physicists find interesting and the problem that the mathematicians find interesting. Oh. Of course, this is a mathematical question, but it hasn't been emphasized to the same degree.
Then sort of recast the correct problem into more mathematical.
Okay, so you're just trying to confuse everybody. The Zucker conjecture is not due to me. I'm Zuckerman.
I'm not trying to
confuse you. Yeah. So there is a case where.
I forgot to do
a lot of it. Yeah. Let me just say it in words. I think it's fruitless to try to write up a complete statement. You can look at the case where G mod K has an invariant complex structure. So that's roughly half the time, like for the case of symplectic groups. And then you study the L2 harmonic forms, as physicists would have you do. He relate that space to the middle intersection homology of the Bailey-Borel compactification. So those are two enormous theories that I don't want to really go into. But that is the one case where there's known to be a geometrical interpretation of L2 harmonic forms. But you have to go into this very elaborate compactification, and you have to except that this middle intersection homology is geometric. So I guess depending upon where you come from, you have different opinions. So I think it's an open problem to give some generalization of the Zucker conjecture to the non-Hermitian case. And notice that I think all the examples that I've been emphasizing are non-Hermitian. For what reason, I don't know. I guess one thing that Aspinwall pointed out in his talk last week is that you somehow want to have quaternions in the game. rather than the complex numbers. And that may explain why the interesting examples are not coming out with complex structures on the symmetric space. Should I say anything more about that? Or? I mean, I think the Zucker conjecture is kind of a sideshow, except that I've been meaning to write a paper with Zucker about this for a long time. Maybe we'll do that. I still don't get to be the first author. That's correct. All right. So let me ask, have I given you at least some sense of what the theorem is saying and what the various ingredients are? Okay. Okay, so to give non-G invariant forms, I think unfortunately I have to go to non-maximal gammas. So this is just the problem with the mathematical literature. And if you allow me to say start with some very large gamma and then pass to a subgroup of finite index, then of course I can find square integral forms. I can already do that with SL2R. With SL2R, if I go to a sufficiently deep congruent subgroup, there will be harmonic one forms. So this is something of a strange situation where we know a lot about these covering spaces that come from choosing subgroups of finite index, but we don't know much about the largest possible arithmetic groups. I'm presuming, for example, that E77Z is a maximal arithmetic subgroup in E77 over the reals. And in that case, I couldn't tell you what's going on. So there again, I'd like to know whether physics really restricts you to the case of these maximal arithmetic groups or whether subgroups can also show up in a natural way.
You mean there are no examples with gamma maximum?
Yeah, well, here's something very peculiar. Let's talk about the case of...
Question.
Yes?
Just to answer maybe this point. I mean, taking orthophobes to the
yeah. In what context do you think?
In orbital.
Oh, I'm sure that there are examples.
So
it's just not the examples that I've been emphasizing. I view an orbifold as just corresponding to fixed points on G mod K. So I don't see what you mean about reducing the group. Oh, of the physical theory. Okay. Yeah, there again, the word orbifold has two different meanings. Oh, okay.
Modulizing torus will preserve the action of that
receptor. Right. Right.
And that will lead you to a smaller group of gamma. I think sometimes it leads to complex.
Any other questions about the statement on the theorem? I still have the theorem on the board.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's a very good question. I mean, you could have asked me that an hour ago, In a sense, what I'm doing is I'm defining harmonic forms as forms on G mod K, which are gamma invariant. Okay. So that's not the same thing as you might do in physics. It may only be part of the picture. Okay. So the explicit definition. So I'll just say a P form on gamma GK is a gamma invariant P form on G mod K. Okay, so that at least gives me something to work with. But I can't say I know very much about these extra forms that would be localized at the singularities. Of course, the singularities are not going to live along submanifolds in general. Gamma equivariant cohomologies. Okay. So that would be something that, as far as I can tell, has not been looked at in the mathematical literature. Although I can't see why not. Now, it's actually through this definition that you start to get towards the proof of this theorem. So what you do is you... Well, let's just talk about forms. So this is the ring of differential forms on gamma G mod K. And this turns out to be the same as the following space. I think for now I'm going to actually take complex coefficients. That'll simplify a few things. Okay, so this is the first mathematical step in understanding the differential forms on this potentially orbifold space. To reinterpret it as a problem in representation theory of K. So remember, what was P? P was the, it's actually the complexification of the tangent space of the symmetric space. Thought of as a representation of K. Okay. And I guess I should put star here to be consistent. So this is just some finite dimensional representation of K. It's actually a rather complicated representation about which something is understood. And we look at the K invariant maps of this finite dimensional representation into this infinite dimensional function space. So, of course, the group G is acting on this space by right translation, and the subgroup K acts by the restriction of that action. Okay. Now, this you could think of as coming from going to the principal bundle picture. You have the picture gamma G, fibers over gamma, GK, with fiber K. And it's well known that lifting to the principal bundle is a good technique in many problems in differential geometry. But then I want to write down the L2 analog of this and say that Now, if I look at the L2 forms, then they can be expressed group theoretically. Now, L2 of G mod gamma is a lot closer to quantum mechanics in the conventional sense. You're talking about your normalizable wave functions on G mod gamma. Now I'd like to discuss not all of the L2 forms on this double coset space, but only those forms which are harmonic. So I need to know something about the Hodge theory on symmetric space. All right, so I have to remind you about the Casimir operator. Well, you see, in effect, you are taking a dual. That duality is built in because this is in the first slot. No, you don't have to do. Remember, you want forms. So forms should take values in at a point in the dual of P.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so it works. It works. Okay, so omega is the Casimir operator. Of G, so that's the complexification. And you see omega operates on forms on G mod K, because the G mod K is a homogeneous space. The Lie algebra operates, and hence omega operates. And so then there's this famous lemma, which I think is sometimes attributed to Kuga, which says that on this space of forms, d dagger plus d dagger d, so there's the Hodge Laplace operator, is actually equal to omega. Okay. All right, so then it follows that we have the following. The L2 harmonic forms on our possibly orbifolded space can be identified with HOM over K, wet star P, into the, I'll just say the zero eigenspace of omega in L2 of G mod gamma. Okay, so this gives us a further reinterpretation of the geometric problem, the so-called supersymmetric ground states, if you accept that interpretation, in terms of a group theoretical problem. All right, so now there's a remarkable result that this zero eigenspace is actually a finite direct sum of irreducible subspaces under the action of the group G. So this is the work of many people. Okay, so I don't think I could possibly indicate the proof of this. It involves the general theory of automorphic forms on semi-simple Lie groups, and also involves a trick for localizing this problem, which I don't think I'm going to try to explain right now. All right, so this says that if we want to get some understanding of degrees in which we can have interesting L2 harmonic forms, we have to understand something about irreducible unitary representations of the group. Now, you might say that's not a problem in differential geometry, so maybe I should stop here, but in fact, there is some interesting geometry connected with these representations. So you can talk about something called the Matsushima class. Yeah. So the Matsushima class is irreducible unitary G rep pi, say in a space H pi, such that mega acts by zero in H pi, and such that this space of intertwiners is non-zero. Okay, so let's call this Matsushima class mat of G. So it was really Matsushima who had the idea of studying this proposition in order to relate representation theory to geometry. This really goes back around 30 years. You should really take it to be this set of equivalence classes. That should be in the fine print somewhere. Yeah. Okay. So I have to briefly tell you about this. This is not a conference on representations of non-compact groups. But at least it's not too hard to state some of the properties of this class. It turns out, first of all, that this class is finite. But more importantly, it's classifiable. So Wee representation theorists know how to write down a complete list. And there's something kind of remarkable about that because you may have heard somewhere in your education about the problem of classifying all unitary irreducible representations of a Lie group. That problem is still not solved, except for low real rank groups, or for GLNR, and a couple of other classes. So it turns out that the theory of this Matsushima class is much simpler and perhaps much more beautiful than the theory of all the unitary representations. For one thing, there are infinitely many unitary representations, but there are only finitely many in this class. It doesn't. What I've done is I've decoupled gamma from the representation theory of G. Okay. So that's why that number MG is just going to have to come from this Matsushima class. So let me just write that down.
What happened?
Exactly. Yeah, so let me write that down. So you can actually write down Matsushima's formula. Now, I think he was careful just to work with compact quotient, because he wanted to do topology rather than physics. Too bad. But the ideas work out just as well. So if you take the dimension of the L2 harmonic forms of degree P on gamma G mod K, and this can now be thought of as a finite sum over the Matsushima class of product of two numbers. You take the dimension of the space of K intertwiners, and you multiply it by the multiplicity of pi in L2 gamma mod G discrete. All right, so I have to append that term discrete, because I want to restrict myself to the discrete part of the decomposition of L2 of G mod gamma into irreducible unitary representations. Okay. So this is the formula that decouples gamma from a problem in the representation theory of G. Of course, these multiplicities are the numbers that you'd really like to know. They're very, very deep numbers. But you try to put them aside for the second and just try to understand these numbers. These numbers are completely known. And these numbers are mysterious. So they're just known to be finite. They are known to be finite. That would be very exciting. Yeah, that would be very exciting.
You'd have to be able to do it for all finite curvatures.
Well, I would be happy to have any example beyond what The kinds of examples where we know something about lower bounds on multiplicities require going to covering spaces. Well, has to do with some rather tricky combinatorics. So I'm not sure how much to say, and we are already close to being out of time. It has to do with the subject of centralizers, which also came up a lot in Ed's talk, but that's probably because we're just doing really basic Lie theory. So,
in particular, the sense that as you vary gamma, certain sort of clumps of cohomology changes that will happen altogether.
Yeah. I view this as some sort of generalization of a Lefschetz decomposition. I think you can make some case for that. What replaces the SL2C is the ring of G invariant forms. I think it might take me a little while to explain that. All right, well, it turns out that what makes this Matsushima class tractable is that it can be understood in terms very similar to the way you classify unitary representations of compact groups. And that is, in the compact case, you have something called the Bott-Borel-Vey theorem. So there's a kind of generalized So what you can do is you can attach to pi a generalized flag manifold. So to get generalized flag varieties, you know, you have to take the complexification of the real group and then divide out by a so-called parabolic subgroup. But then this can also be viewed as G modulo L, where L is the centralizer in G of an element in K naught. So you're looking at very special centralizer groups. Now, the Q and the L are not quite unique, but it turns out that different choices differ only by compact factors. So then it turns out that the that this factor that is supposed to be the known factor can be computed in terms of this associated data. It's cohomology with a shift of LU modulo LU intersected K. So I have to use again my concept of the compact twist of a group. And the shift here is to maintain Poincaré duality. So now you can begin to see where the Cormorazon part of Sardi theorem comes from. You have to work through all of these subgroups that arise by centralizing elements in the compact subalgebra. Now that number of groups in type is only finite, but the number grows very rapidly with the rank of the group. So I would guess in case of SO4,20, there are thousands, if not tens of thousands, of such groups. But you could, in principle, write them all down. No, actually, I'm not quite counting right, because there's some slightly additional data here. There may be fewer such groups. Okay, so now I haven't actually constructed the representation. I've just told you how to write down this all-important space of intertwiners. So what I would actually call a generalized Bott-Borel-Vey theorem would be the statement that let's put this up here. All right, so by the way, this is joined with David Vogan in the MIT math department. So just to give you a rough idea, the H pi embeds into a particular cohomology group. Let me just put question marks there for a second and I'll come back. This is relative to a choice of G-invariant complex structure. On G mod L. So I'm looking at the differential forms of type PQ. I think these numbers are first one is the complex dimension, G mod L. And the second number is the complex dimension of K mod K intersection L. Okay, so there's two numbers that are naturally attached to this homogeneous space, G mod L. And it's in this sense that this is a Bott-Borel-Vey type construction. It's a construction using a complex structure on a homogeneous space and picking out a particular cohomology group. And then this is actually dense embedding. Now, There are other people involved in this as well. SPID and his student Wang. Because actually what Vogan and I did was much more algebraic and then was put into a more geometrical formulation by Schmidt and Wang. So maybe that gives you a flavor of what these representations look like. The difficulty of this geometrical construction is that although you can get a lot of data about pi, it's very hard to see what the inner product is. It's very hard to write down an inner product on a D-bar cohomology group on a non-compact manifold. So I'll end with that comment.
Is there any simplification that takes place if you assume gamma is so nice that T mod K mod gamma is a manifold?
Yeah, so as far as the mathematics goes, when you make that assumption, you're going to expect to have more cohomology, not less, as we've been talking about. There's something called the Selberg trace formula, which has some bearing on what we're talking about. I believe it becomes simpler when you don't have orbifold points. But unfortunately, the trace formula doesn't really get you very far in this business.
Yeah, I'm heading in that direction.
Yeah.
But this is remarkable. If I understand it, you've got this number. Let's assume gamma is one of the nice arithmetic stuff.
Right.
You've got this number, and that if you have a harmonic form,
square integrable. That's important.
Compact.
Oh, no. Oh, you're assuming compactness?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Did I miss something that you said? Maybe I wasn't paying attention.
I was assuming gamma is big enough so that T mod K mod gamma is compact.
Let's see. If the quotient starts out to be non-compact, when I pass to a finite quotient, finite cover, it's still non-compact. So what I have to do is I have to choose my arithmetic group very carefully. It has to be a rather sophisticated arithmetic group in order to get the quotient to be compact.
No, I agree with that.
But it's not just a question of passing to a subgroup of finite index.
Okay. But I'm still curious about that case because it has a lot more geometry in it.
All right.
Special. In the case where G mod K mod gamma
is a smooth compact manifold. I think the problems are still just as difficult.
And so there still is, because you said it's independent of gamma.
Right.
So I could have picked one.
You could have picked one that has such a nice property.
Then you're saying that there is this integer that if you had a harmonic form on this compact that degree or less, then, in fact, over in a compact G mod K, there's got to be a corresponding.
Right. It's another way to state the theorem.
But are there always the co-compact degree?
Yeah, that's another theorem of Borel. No matter what G you choose, there is a co-compact discrete subgroup. Arithmetic. He uses an arithmetic construction. It's an old paper from the early 60s. I think these groups have been coming up in discussions with Greg Moore. Even constructing these for SL2R is not so easy because you want them to be arithmetic. They're not just arbitrary fundamental groups of compact Riemann surfaces. They're very special co-compact discrete subgroups of SL2R. Yeah, so I agree. You have a whole subdomain of this, where the G mod K mod gamma is as nice as possible geometrically, but the numbers are still a total mystery.
That number seems a total mystery to me.
Yeah, well, like I said, I think people tried to get those numbers out from purely curvature-type arguments, and then they ended up failing miserably.
It's another stunt to try here. I don't know whether anyone tried it. You want to think, say, G mod K mod gamma, having recovering space G mod K with discrete group G.
With discrete group gamma, you mean?
Sorry.
Yeah.
Discrete group gamma.
Yeah.
Then you want to think of gamma invariance. Let me just draw.
Sure.
Then you want to study invariant forms on here, or cohomology on here, and I want to think of it as cohomology on here, invariant under this group G, and therefore under the group algebra of G, of gamma, I should say, and I'm going to be talking about group algebras of such discrete groups, gamma, tomorrow, and the point is, there's an index theorem here. I wanted to get at these results on cohomology via index theorem, naturally.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the index theorem here is that index up in here for an appropriate operator, invariant under gamma, appropriately defined index, because these are going to be modules over this group algebra, appropriately defined index up here, which will come to L2 harmonic forms, is the same as the ordinary index down here. So specifically, for example, suppose this were complex and you're talking about D bar cohomology around the index or D bar cohomology down here. Then the theorem is that the index down here for D bar will be D bar will lift because it's covering. It'll be index of D bar in a more sophisticated case as a module counting kernels and co-kernels as modules of this space. Yeah. And that index theory up here is going to be related to L2 cohomology on T mod K. So you'll get some information relating L2 cohomology here with ordinary cohomology down here. The index parts. And that's why I wondered what happened in this case.
By index, do you mean a quadratic dimension?
Pardon?
By index, do you